Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org. Scroll down the main page of our website and click on the big red oval for the streaming link to our live online radio service, or simply tune in with your good old-fashioned, old-style radio, doesn't have to be digital, to 101.3 FM here in Santa Cruz, California, the central north coast of North America. Hi, my name is Ren, and this is Mideast Migraines. Don't flip out. It's the same program I've been doing here for a good year and a half now, or so. Once upon a long time ago, it began its feeble life as Don't Beat Me Up, a show entitled Don't Beat Me Up, and that was good for maybe a month. And then I decided, nobody understands me with a dumb title like that. Let's just change the title to Mideast Madness. At the suggestion of a good friend and fellow collective member. So, until a couple of weeks ago, this was the Mideast Madness Show. It is now Mideast Migraines, coming to you every Monday at 3 p.m. for about a couple of hours. There is also Mideast Migraines, the weekend edition, every Saturday from 11 a.m. until 1 p.m. And the schedule may also be found on our website at freakradio.org. My friends, it is 3:07 p.m. That's 1,507 hours. Actually, 1,500 hours and 7 minutes. On this December 30th, 2013, the eve of New Year's Eve. Now, if that date and time jives with your personal time-space continuum, then you know the show is live and you may call in at any time. And help turn the show from a mundane monolithic monologue of me reading at you all the time, interspersed with a little bit of music, to a dialogue between listener and radio host. Here's the phone number, area code, here in Santa Cruz County, California, U.S. of A. Area code 831-427-3772. Once more, 831-427-3772. And again, my name is Ren Tawil. I'm your regular host here on Mideast Migraines. All right. Now, see, here's the thing. I'm a Palestinian American, born and bred in the San Francisco Bay Area, born up in Frisco itself, as was my mother. My father, rest his soul, was born and bred Jerusalem side over there in old Palestine. He was born during the First World War, meaning that when the day he was born, the day my dad was born, Palestine was experiencing the death throes of a 400-year-old foreign occupation by the Turkish Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans sided with the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians in that war, which lost, of course, to France, Great Britain, Russia, and the United States. This was at a time when Russia was inevitably thrown into the war because they were the Eastern Front and were battling the Austro-Hungarians and Germans on that side, while on the other side in the West, France and Britain and not terribly soon, the United States joined in and the bad guys won. The bad guys lost the World War I in a pincer movement. Anyway, so as the First World War came to a close, the Ottomans lost control of Palestine and that whole general part of the Arab world, retreating into the north centralmost portion of their former empire and what is now called Turkey. That country has been in existence still and mightily in fairly powerful form since the end of World War I. And so my father's country continued living under the iron hand of a foreign occupier. Power was passed over from the Ottoman Turks to Great Britain, as did Jordan and Iraq. France took over Syria and Lebanon. And now, since that time, the rest of the Middle East pretty much evolved slowly, with a great deal of trepidation, and Arab nations emerged. The aforementioned Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan all came into their own as independent states as their foreign occupiers released control, and the powers that were the political elite in those countries fought with and negotiated, alternatively, probably several times, with Great Britain and France to acquire their independence. Palestine was a remarkable different story. In the mid to late 1800s, this would be the 19th century, in the 1800s, there was a growing settler movement of Jews from various parts of the globe into Palestine, first with the permission of the Turkish occupiers. They bought land, very often right from underneath the noses of the Arabic residents, Arabic-speaking natives of historic Palestine. and often to their chagrin as well. This settler movement was sparked on in a single moment by a conference that took place in Switzerland. I believe it was Basel, Switzerland. The conference was founded, organized, and largely headed by a Theodor Herzl, H-E-R-Z-L, who himself, he was a European Jew, and he declared and set the course of that conference in Switzerland to the foundation of a movement called Zionism. Zionism, on the surface, and quite exclusively, was for the purpose of establishing, occupying, and maintaining a new homeland, a physical national homeland for the Jewish people of the world. There were actually a number of interesting offers made by governments around the world for a location of this new Jewish homeland, including what became the country of Uganda. I believe it was also under the control of Great Britain, or some portion of Uganda. And believe it or not, even a recommendation for a Jewish homeland in Canada. I can appreciate the lack of interest that Jews would have in moving to those places. And in both cases, places where other people were already living, and certainly in the case of Canada, a well-established government and culture of white former Europeans. If I were Jewish, I probably wouldn't have been attracted to either of those locations or any of the various other locations. Well, of course, inevitably, Palestine came into the picture as a prospective home for the Jews. After all, their ancient religious forebears were from there. They even had a small, very short-lived empire some 2,500 years ago. In its most stable period, it lasted for some 70 to 200 years. And then mighty empires and governments and those who would control others being the rule of the norm, the Israelite nations, and there were a variety of them who kind of hemmed and hawed, waxed and waned, went through their personal history. They were often invaded. They were certainly occupied by the Romans. And you will hear and read, if you do some study on this history, about a number of, some small number of what are referred to exiles of the Jewish people. The first most famous or infamous exile, as it were, of course, refers to the flight of the ancient Hebrew people, predecessors of the modern Jews, at least in terms of religious affiliation. Their flight from Egypt and subsequent exile in the land of milk and honey, which, according to their holy scriptures, was promised to them by God. So, which on the one hand was freedom for the Hebrew people from the clutches of the Egyptian pharaoh, in a new land which the Jews declared for themselves had to be redeemed, it was offered to them by God for the proper redemption of the land, as they refer to it, it was also considered an exile, which to me is kind of bizarre. I mean, did they ever expect to return back to Egypt? At any rate, that was the first great exile. The one most generally referred to in common religious culture. And then there were the Roman occupation eventually came about, occupying Israel or Canaan, the land of the Philistines, earlier names for that area before it was ever called the land of Israel or where the Israelites lived. And Babylon, the Babylonian Empire eventually conquered Palestine, Philistia, whatever you want to call it, Canaan, Samaria, which really refers to an even older civilization which predated the Israelites, Judea, etc. The Babylonians came in and conquered that area for a time. They took slaves of the Israelites and perhaps other non-Israelite peoples, namely the earlier Canaanites, and brought them into Babylon to the north, to the northeast and to the east. And eventually, most of those, or maybe fewer than half of those who survived that sort of national kidnapping, returned to Israel. And so again, you hear the word exile coming into play there, even though it was, to a degree, reversed. By this time, by about this time and shortly after, and I'm not a terribly strong scholar in this area, but if anyone wants to refute the history as I recount it, by all means, please call in, area code 831-427-3772. As I was saying, what left of the grander part of Israeli history following that period, the land of Israel just kind of sort of fell apart, at least in terms of ancient Israel being and continuing to be a cohesive, viable national homeland for the Jews. The Jewish people, who kept ardently to their beliefs, their traditions, and their faith in God, moved out to the east into the Persian Empire. Thousands and thousands of them, probably well over a million or two, actually, in the course of history, continuing to flourish in the Persian, the land of the Persians, and even in modern-day Iran. To this day, there are many thousands of Jews who still live in modern-day Iran. Yes, you heard me. That's not to say that they are not experiencing persecution and discrimination by the mostly Islamic Iranian/Persian people. There's plenty of that going around. There's no question about that. But the point is, the Jews moved, established, and maintained for many centuries, in some cases for a couple of millennia, their presence in ancient Persia, in Europe, going up through southeastern Europe, the Balkans, moving into Russia, what became Russia and eventually the Soviet Union, the rest of Europe, portions of Africa, all the Arab nations, or what would become the 22 or so Arab nations which comprise the International Arab League, and in most or all of the Arabic countries, there remain to this day some Jews who chose not to leave, or who frankly managed to escape Arab pogroms from those countries into Israel and into other parts of the world. So the Jews, in all of their sincere and very real traditions and adherence to their faith and their beliefs and practices, have acquired a kind of very broad presence around the globe. And here this Theodor Herzl in Switzerland chose to reverse that, sparked on largely by these terrible pogroms or massacres leading up to expulsions of Jews from Russia. There were a series of them. And in other countries too, including European countries, this is all before the Nazis came about. And we all know what happened under the Nazi regime for some 12 terrible years. And Theodor Herzl saw and formulated Zionism as a means to protect the future of the Jewish religion and the future of the Jewish people and to renationalize them in a single turf. Now, when I started talking about this some 18 minutes ago, you may remember I said that at its most basic, political Zionism, not religious or theological Zionism, but as a political movement, the Zionist philosophy was essentially and simply to reestablish a home for the Jewish people, for world Jewry, as they say, J-E-W-R-Y, in Palestine, as it turned out. Not a great surprise to a number of people. But what did not gain as much attention, if any attention, from other people who supported the Zionist cause was that Zionism was an exclusivist, and to this day is an exclusionary philosophy seeking 100% of the population in their land to be Jewish. That was the original idea. Because of the total impracticality of that, and practically speaking, because of the failure of the Jews in 1948 and in 1967 to drive out every last non-Jewish Arab Gentile from the modern state of Israel, they had to make do. And now we're hearing about such things as recent laws passed and enforced by the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, stating specific thresholds, official lines in the sand in terms of the portion of the population, that they have to maintain a minimum of 70% of the Israeli population to be Jewish in order to get things done as they saw fit. This has led to terrible ethnic cleansing and was largely the result of terrible ethnic cleansing in both 48, 49, and 1967 of the native Palestinian Arab population, both Muslim and Christian. The Christians have suffered largely from this, in many cases, just as much as the Muslims have, from the Israeli ethnic cleansing of non-Jewish people from this new Jewish state. Again, call me if you wish to discuss this further, up or down, in or out, area code 831-427-3772. Here on the west coast of North America. Okay, it's 3:26. I am, therefore, the Palestinian-American host of Mideast Migraines. Essentially the same show as has been going on for the past 18 months here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, streaming live at freakradio.org, also broadcasting now at 101.3 on your FM dial. 101.3. Tell everyone we're back on the air after a 5.5-month hiatus of being confined to the technological barrios of the internet. We're still streaming. We are still an online internet service on the World Wide Web, but we're also an old-fashioned radio service at 101.3 FM. Okay. I think I wrapped up that whole thing, that historical rendition, properly and completely. Let me drag down a not so ice cold Diet Cola there. I like to talk about the United Nations, and my regular listeners, one of the thousands and thousands of people who've listened to this program every week, twice a week, have heard me talk about the UN. I'm a UN kind of guy. It's one of the most beleaguered and fraught with criticism organizations in the world is the United Nations. Not so terribly surprising, given the fact that they're taking on the problems of the entire globe. It is difficult for them to be much more than a debate society, although they do have many, many successful development programs ongoing around the world. If not anywhere close to establishing a utopia on this planet, or any utopia anywhere, at least they are to some degree successful in maintaining the health, education, and welfare of people and children at key points around the globe. Key points where a lot of strife has been experienced before the arrival of the UN. And even in the presence of the UN, there's a lot of turmoil going on. Well, just got this, picked this up 3 days ago. General Assembly wraps up work with approval of $5.5 billion United Nations budget for 2014-2015. Let's see what this is about. New York, December 27, 6 p.m. The General Assembly today wrapped up its work for the main part of the 68th session by approving a budget of $5.5 billion, U.S. dollar equivalents, I take it, for the United Nations to carry out its vital work over the next 2 years. The 193-member body approved the budget for the biennium 2014 to 2015, by consensus, acting on the recommendation of its committee dealing with administrative and budgetary matters, today known as the Fifth Committee. Interesting title, Fifth Committee. Those of you who are into the modern film culture won't have difficulty in figuring out what I'm talking about, which concluded its work earlier today. The new budget is lower than the one for the previous biennium, reflecting our shared wish for a financially responsible secretariat, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said in a message delivered to the assembly meeting by his chef de cabinet, Susanna Malcora, following the decision. We will continue to adapt and equip the United Nations to better implement its mandates, he said, Ban Ki-moon said, adding that he has urged all managers to rethink their business practices, reduce overlap, embrace innovation, encourage creativity, and build synergies. At the same time, he voiced disappointment that the Assembly failed to reach agreement on two, quote, critically important reform proposals, namely a managed mobility policy and strengthened arrangements for partnership with the private sector. The Assembly decided to defer consideration of these two proposals to next spring. Okay. Mr. Bon also stated that it would be unrealistic to presume that any substantial budget reduction will have no impact while mandates keep growing. The time may have come for you to consider reviewing mandated activities, that may have been fulfilled or overtaken by new developments, he stated. In his closing, Assembly President John Ash noted that today's conclusion of the Fifth Committee, which normally wraps up its work just prior to Christmas, again underscored the need to adapt, indeed revitalize, the Assembly's working methods. As the work of our organization gets more challenging, so does its financial and administrative needs. We, therefore, need to ensure that the ways in which we deal with these challenges have evolved and that the approaches of yesteryear also need to evolve if we are to have a fully functional organization, he told member states. Noting the need for adequate time to consider all aspects of what is now, quote, a fairly detailed and intricate UN budget, he said that perhaps the time has come to look at either a dedicated session of the Fifth Committee for this process or to have the introduction of the budget at the outset of the committee's work rather than in late October, as is the current practice. Discussing some of the achievements of the session, Mr. Ash reported that the Assembly adopted 259 resolutions and took 66 decisions, covering a wide range of issues, from nuclear disarmament to the rule of law at national and international levels, and from financing for development to the peaceful use of outer space. The session also saw new resolutions introduced on the right to privacy, introduced on the right to privacy and the safety of journalists, as well as a resolution designed to strengthen the United Nations Economic and Social Council, ECOSOC. End of news dispatch. For more details, go to UN News Center at www.un.org/news. UN.org/news if you're interested in this UN stuff. Okay, thank you for sitting through that. Inevitably, these dispatches are very dry and often filled with suspiciously empty-sounding wording. I'm not saying that they're lying about everything. I'm just saying they obviously have very high hopes for getting stuff done. But I just wanted people to know that the UN, they're working on it. Whether it has anything to do with your immediate life, your personal economy, the terribly high cost of gasoline, whether or not you're getting laid these days, that little herpy that you have on your lip that's really killing you, at least you know there's something going on in the real world out there. Okay. Now, a lot of recent stuff about BDS, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement against the cultural and academic life of Israel. I'm not going to get into that right now. There's a lot of other important things I want to talk about. From Mariam Zoni, Z-O-H-N-Y, Mariam Zoni. Friday, December 27, the ongoing Nakba, Palestinian refugees from Syria in Lebanon. Of course, this person is talking about those Arabs who lived in many cases for many, many generations and many hundreds of years in Palestine, who became refugees from their expulsion by the Zionist partisans who created their new Israeli state in place of Palestine. Palestinian refugees who had to escape the death and destruction and terror perpetrated by the nascent Israelis, who went into various other countries and certainly into Israel's Arab neighbors, Syria being one of them. And of course the word Nakba, N-A-K-B-A, Nakba, is Arabic for catastrophe. This is the ongoing Nakba, Palestinian refugees from Syria and Lebanon. This report was issued by the National Institute of Social Care and Vocational Training. Since the start of the Syrian uprising, Palestinian refugees from Syria, the PRS, have attempted to remain relatively neutral in the conflict. Talking about the Syrian uprising now and it's entering its fourth year, I believe. However, as the conflict escalated both surrounding and within Yarmouk refugee camp in the Damascus suburbs, Palestinian refugees have become increasingly impacted. Between December 2012 and January 2013, a steady and growing flow of PRS began seeking refuge in Lebanon, and now the country is host to over 30,000 PRS. This according to ANERA, the A-N-E-R-A. Additionally, these approximate figures are expected to be higher than reported, as many have yet to be registered. At least someone's out there counting them. To whatever end, I'm not sure. Lebanon is already host to approximately 440,000 Palestinian refugees who were exiled during the 1948 Nakba, the creation of the State of Israel, and subsequent wars and massacres. Moreover, Lebanon is also currently host to an estimated 1 million Syrian refugees, those who have fled the civil war, the current civil war in Syria. That does not include former Palestinians who were already made into refugees. 1 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. Within this context, PRS are particularly vulnerable due to the lack of support they receive from both national and international organizations. Unlike Syrian refugees who receive assistance from UNHCR and a plethora of other organizations, all of whose efforts have yet to fully meet the needs of the overwhelming Syrian refugee population in Lebanon, PRS, again, me standing for Palestinian Refugees in Syria, only receive assistance from UNRWA, according to United Nations mandates, and a limited number of other non-governmental organizations. Even preceding the Syrian refugee crisis, UNRWA was severely underfunded and has had difficulty meeting the basic needs of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. Moreover, UNRWA resources and facilities are inadequate and unable to absorb the influx of these additional refugees. Thus, the limited and scarce resources available to PRS in Lebanon place them in a particularly vulnerable situation. While local NGOs try to complement UNRWA services, they too are chronically underfunded. By the way, there are a couple of vivid pictures of the starkness of life for refugees. Not terribly revealing, but the two that are here involve the corners of rooms, barren, Spartan, unadorned concrete, and I guess some kind of stucco interiors of square rooms with a carpet or two on the floor, with pillows that are adorned with embroidery, etc., stacked up against the wall. And this says, to me, says something about the living conditions in the sleeping quarters for many refugees. And I, too, have personally witnessed these facilities in the Gaza Strip. Even within the city, or adjoining the city of Gaza City, in so-called Free Palestine, almost unbelievable what these people have, which is basically nothing. Most of them fleeing with the clothes on their back and what little they could carry. Okay, continuing with this article here. Palestinian refugees from Syria are now refugees for the second or third time in their lives, in some cases more. After the 1948 exile of Palestinians from their homeland, in what is termed al-Nakba, or catastrophe, Palestinians were forced to seek refuge in neighboring Arab countries, such as Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan, and others. Others were internally displaced to other regions of Palestine. What was expected to be a temporary displacement has resulted in an over 65-year occupation of their homeland. While Palestinian refugees under international law have a legal right to return to their homeland, I'm going to read that again. While Palestinian refugees under international law have a legal right to return to their homeland, as are all refugee populations, they have been consistently denied this right, including by the state of Israel, denied by Israel, with the international community failing to effectively advocate on their behalf. This makes the Palestinian refugee crisis the longest-lasting refugee crisis, creating the single largest refugee population on Earth in modern times. The substantial influx of refugees, particularly in Lebanon's most impoverished areas, has had a profound effect on the financial situation of both poor Lebanese nationals, as well as an even more profound negative impact on the Palestinian refugee community already established in Lebanon. Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, as well as the poor Lebanese, have been driven into greater poverty and unemployment since Syrian refugees are accepting jobs for lower wages. Due to the increased labor supply, employers have been able to demand more work for less pay and have even dismissed local staff, their own Lebanese nationals, in favor of refugees who are willing to work for less. For Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, who are prohibited from working in over 72 professions, the effect has been devastating. Many manual labor and black market jobs have been filled by Syrian refugees, or PRS. According to a recent ANERA needs assessment report, this has made PRS, and I quote here, the most vulnerable subpopulation affected by the crisis. Palestinian refugees from Syria have fewer legal protections than other communities, no legal employment possibilities, not legal ones anyway, and are mostly to be lodged with the poorest host communities in Lebanon. Furthermore, the international response to their particular needs has been markedly less than for general Syrian refugees, end quote. PRS have primarily sought housing in the scattered 12 refugee camps of Lebanon, many of which are already overcrowded. Many live in substandard conditions in shelters such as garages, shacks, shops, and public buildings, with as many as 10 to 15 persons living in a single quarter. Moreover, many PRS lack the most basic facilities such as refrigerators, electricity, and access to running water. Some do not even have toilets or bathrooms in their living quarters, forcing them to use public lavatories or the bathrooms of their neighbors. These harsh living circumstances will only worsen during the cold and wet winter months. There is a desperate need to increase efforts to support PRS in Lebanon for the winter season. Lebanon has faced one of the coldest winters in over 100 years, and it is only the beginning of winter, that is, of course. Organizations in Lebanon are rapidly trying to meet the needs of the refugee population by providing winter items, including heaters, blankets, and winter clothing. Unfortunately, since PRS, Palestinian refugees of and from Syria, do not benefit from the services of most international and local organizations in Lebanon, they are left particularly vulnerable and will not have access to the basic resources necessary to keep their families warm and secure. Only a handful of organizations are specifically targeting PRS families, however. They are unable to cover even a fraction of the needs and reach only a limited number of families. Some organizations have initiated creative fundraising campaigns to fill the gaps, such as the National Institute of Social Care and Vocational Training, more commonly known as Bait Atfal Asumond, or BAS. The NISCVT, that National Institute of Social Care and Vocational Training, is a Palestinian-run Lebanese NGO, non-governmental organization, operating in the Palestinian refugee camps of Lebanon, established primarily as an orphanage for orphans of the Tal el-Zatar massacre. NISCVT now operates community centers in all 12 Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, acting primarily as a kindergarten and early education center. NISCVT also provides a plethora of youth and community-based activities, as well as social relief services. NISCVT's existence is a reminder of the ongoing nature of al-Nakba, the 1948 catastrophe. As PRS families struggle to survive the winter months, aid organizations are also struggling to meet the high needs of the refugee community. While the international donor community neglects PRS, organizations hope the international community may hear their calls and support PRS this winter, for the worst is yet to come. To support the NISCVT's winter campaign, please click here. Folks out there, you can go to www.gofundme.com/refugee winter camp. Straight across, as I said, gofundme.com/refugee winter camp. The very last paragraph of this report brings to mind the tediousness of so many of us Western people whose lives are not affected at all by the misfortune of these people, and who even some of us are tempted to dismiss the refugees as just a bothersome bunch who leech off of the other countries surrounding Israel. At least some of them are trying to establish their own creative fundraising campaigns, National Institute of Social Care and Vocational Training, etc. These are NGOs, non-governmental organizations. So there is some creative pulling up the bootstraps of these individuals going on. But as it says here, while the international donor community neglects PRS, neglects the Palestinian refugees from Syria, their own organizations hope that that community may hear their calls. Okay, that's the Syrian situation there. By the way, it is 3:51 p.m. this Monday, December 30th. The day before New Year's Eve, which is the day before the new year, 2014, and the nightmare just carries on and on, doesn't it? Into a new year. Now, 3:52 p.m., December 30th, the show is live. You know I'm here and I'll talk to you. If that jives with your personal reality, call me at area code 831- 3772 8314. I'm sorry, I gave you the wrong number. Area code is 831. The preface of the local phone number is 427-3772. Didn't sound right the first time. 427-3772. Oh, and by the way, I'm going blind here. I need new glasses.
I can't afford new glasses.
Okay. Yeah. We'll take a musical break. Like, right now, because this next one is a long one. But given the title, The Nightmare Hidden Within Liberal Zionism, I think we want to feel refreshed, take a five-minute breather and bathroom break, or for whatever, and come back refreshed and ready to hear the rest of this.
الكم وساني اول غنيني الكم وساناسي اشطب غناسي الكم وساني اول غنيني الكم وساناسي اشطب غناسي
And the music you're listening to today takes us back to Ozzy's album of 2003. Ozzy is a local Moroccan / Middle Eastern / Western fusion band and bunch of singers. This is from the Marrakech album of 2003, local band here in Santa Cruz, California. Certain Moment Publishing Limited, 2003. And that is what that is. Okay, folks, it's 1600 hours Pacific Standard Time, 4 o'clock p.m. this Monday, December 30th, 2013. I'm still live and here at that time and space. Coincides with your personal one. I'm here in, live in the studio at 831-427-3772. By all means, feel free to give me a call at 831-427-3772. If the bad guys are listening in, for strictly for purposes of, as they see it, monitoring the anti-Semites and the Jew haters, I am neither one of those things, but the bad guys, you know who you are. And you figure you got to keep your ear on me and your eye on me. Call me anyway. I don't give an F. One way or another. One way or the other. Also, by the way, if you don't want to have a two-way dialogue right now over the telephony, don't forget the email address for this program, MideastMadness@gmx.com. Now, the new name for the program is and shall be, henceforth, Mideast Migraines. Coming to you every Monday at 3 p.m. and every Saturday at 11 a.m., 11 in the morning. Two separate shows. But, of course, why go through the hassle of changing the name of the email address? That shall remain MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's G as in gregarious, M as in Machiavellian, X as in Xerxes.com. Mideast Madness at GMX.com. Leave your messages there. All right. Return to the proper folder here. I also wanted to remind everyone, Saturdays, until we get to the very end of the book, I am reading a book entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel by Mr. Max Blumenthal, an American Jew. One of a great many Jews, and the number is growing day by day, who are not merely becoming frustrated or tired of the stupid or just plain bad way that the Israeli government is handling things, and not merely disgusted at the terrible misdeeds of the Israeli military, their so-called defense forces. Many Jews in this country and abroad, and certainly inside Israel, are becoming plain-ass disenfranchised with the awfulness of Israeli policy, Israeli actions, of the whole idea of Zionism, and seriously calling into question whether the promise of Zionism, a truly peaceful, forward-moving, all-Jewish country, can be or can become, whether or not that's viable, whether or not that's a realistic goal, or even a worthy goal. I mean, the rest of the world, if anything, is headed towards multiculturalism, multi-religiousism, or at least inclusion of people who are different than you, while Israel continues to ethnic cleanse its Gentile population and treat oh so horribly, and very often just plain kill, destroy the lives of those Palestinian Arabs under occupation, under military occupation. And make no mistake, it is a truly and continues to be a military occupation of the West Bank and a de facto occupation and economic siege of the Gaza Strip. There is, I have been struck by the number of instances in recent months that I have come across of the formal whitewashing of some of the worst of Israel's deeds. Like, well, as I just mentioned, many of them are being spoon-fed this BS about there not being, supposedly not being, a military occupation of the West Bank, when it's so obvious that that is what's going on and that is continuing, and that if anything is getting far worse and strangling the life out of the native Palestinian Arabs in the West Bank. This broad whitewash trying to convince the world, oh no, the idea of an occupation is gone now. That's not what's really happening. And then they have this totally illogical, non-congruent, non sequitur explanation for what's really going on, and it doesn't make any sense. I've read stuff about how the attack on the United States ship Liberty, the USS Liberty, in 1967, in international waters off the coast of Israel, by Israeli warplanes, followed by another 30-minute attack by the Israeli Navy in their torpedo boats, which took the lives of 33 American servicemen, sailors, most likely because the Liberty was an intelligence ship that the Israelis were afraid were going to report back electronically to the Pentagon that Israel was about to attack Syria's Golan Heights, which is exactly what ended up happening shortly after the attack, the assault on the Liberty. That phrase, assault on the Liberty, is taken from the book written by the surviving sailors of that attack. Another whitewash effort by those who support Israel and consider themselves to be Zionists in God's army of Zionists, they'll say, no, 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 that was a mistake. The whole thing was not perpetrated intentionally by the Israeli military, their Air Force and their Navy. Even though we're talking about a variety of interesting things that happened, there were at least a couple of pilots, Israeli pilots, who, when they recognized the U.S. flags and the ship is not being Egyptian, which is what they purported to begin with, they refused to participate in the attack, and those refuseniks, were subsequently jailed and punished by Israel, by their IDF. The trace plane that was seen in the area was reported to have Egyptian markings, even though there was no Egyptian tracer plane, airplane there. A sustained half-hour-long air attack was supposedly a mistake, right? And the following 30-minute-long naval attack by surface ships, Israeli Navy surface ships, was also a mistake. Yeah, right. This information is being passed along by a very gullible population of Jews, both inside Israel and out. Terrible propaganda. And to other supporters of Israel. Lots of crap like this is going on around now. Okay. Now, I don't even remember how I got going on that. But, that's right. I'm going to read you this. It's 4:09, so let's get going on this one. Author David Lloyd is from the Electronic Intifada. So it is an article and obviously an extended opinion, but it has some very fascinating material here. The nightmare hidden within liberal Zionism. For the uninitiated, there is a segment of the Israeli population, the Israeli populace, and America of Americans who, even though they believe in this antiquated, full of ethnic cleansing idea called Zionism, there is a sector of it who consider themselves to be liberal Zionists. In other words, more inclined to be passionate towards non-Jews, to be passionate toward the Palestinian Arabs who were there before the Israelis. We're not talking ancient history. We're talking about the modern-day way of dealing with these problems through verbal intercourse, debate, discussion, and facts on the ground, not according to ancient scripture of anybody's religion. This is how we do things now in the 20th and 21st centuries. The liberal Zionist is someone who may consider themselves still to be essentially Zionist, pro-Israel, and still in favor of the idea of at least a majority Jewish state in Palestine/Israel, but they are in solidarity with the peaceful, with the nonviolent efforts of Palestinian Arabs to achieve their state and achieve their rights and sovereignty and hopefully their independence. Okay, the nightmare hidden within liberal Zionism. David Lloyd, Electronic Intifada, 21 December. Since the American Studies Association, the ASA, announced this month, December, that its members had voted overwhelmingly to endorse the boycott of Israeli and academic institutions, the predictable outpouring of furious responses has been proliferating. They range from former Harvard President Larry Summers' recycling of the threadbare charge that the boycott is tantamount to anti-Zionism, to the sound bites of homophobic, Islamophobic venom that have been spewed onto ASA's Facebook page and into the inboxes of its officers. Of course, referring to email inboxes. And possibly paper inboxes as well. Anyway, but surely the most disingenuous of responses to date is that of the Crisis of Zionism author and Open Zionism editor Peter Beinart in the Daily Beast. Despite the fact that Beinart eschews the overheated and overtly bigoted language deployed by other critics, and these will be compiled in a document entitled The Real Problem with the American Studies Association's Boycott of Israel, 17 December. Reading on here, indeed, Beinart generously exonerates the ASA from anti-Semitic tendencies, though the ASA has no need of his good graces on that score. It would have been better for Beinart to consider whether the really anti-Semitic gesture is not the Zionist demand that all Jews, no matter what their political or ethical beliefs, accept a single state as their representative and offer their allegiance to it, even if it is founded on discrimination, exclusion, and ethnic cleansing. To demand such an identification of all Jews is not only to dismiss the growing number of Jews worldwide who are challenging the nature of the, quote, Jewish state, but also to erase centuries of diverse and non-Zionist Jewish traditions. Let me read that short paragraph again. To demand such an identification of all Jews towards Israel is not only to dismiss the growing number of Jews worldwide who are challenging the nature of the Jewish state, but also to erase centuries of diverse and non-Zionist Jewish traditions. Peter Beinart also gives the ASA a pass on inconsistency, both for being an academic association boycotting academic institutions and for seeming to single out Israel for special attention. The ASA doubtlessly welcomes his dispensation, even though what it really reveals is his complete misunderstanding of the history and practice of boycott as a political tactic deployed by social movements. New section, new subsection here. Quote, Orwellian, end quote. But it is at the very heart of his column that Beinart reveals the peculiar and irresolvable contradictions that afflict the would-be liberal Zionist in the extraordinary contortions of truly Orwellian language that are required to magic those contradictions away. Let me let Ren just step in here and explain for those who are unfamiliar. Orwellian refers to author George Orwell. That's his ghost writer's name. Eric Blair was his birth name, but George Orwell, the writer, was the author, of course, of 1984, who introduced in that novel phrases such as doublespeak, which say one thing and effectively mean another, because the words they're using would be more readily acceptable by the people they control. So Orwellian refers to the situation in 1984 where the world is controlled by, I think, three or four major powers who constantly and alternately declare war on one another in order to keep the allegiance of people of its people to the fascist dictates of those leaders. Book was written in 1948. You see, switch the numbers 48 and you get 84, as in the title of 1984. So Orwellian refers to the philosophy and the terrible scenario that George Orwell referred to there. Again, under the subtitle Orwellian, but it is at the very heart of his column that Peter Beinart reveals the peculiar and irresolvable contradictions that afflict the would-be liberal Zionist and the extraordinary contortions of truly Orwellian language that are required to magic those contradictions away. How else, indeed, can one manage to normalize a state that has made itself an exception in every possible way while demanding to be viewed as the, and I quote, only democracy in the Middle East, end quote? Mr. Beinart accuses the ASA and the Palestinian boycott movement as a whole of covertly, quote, opposing the existence of a Jewish state within any borders, end quote. They refuse, he complains, to distinguish between the West Bank, where Palestinians lack citizenship, the right to vote, and the right to due process, and Israel proper, where Palestinians, although discriminated against, enjoy all three. It's a nice sleight of hand. Admitting that there is discrimination in Israel takes the reader's eye off the real game, which is to pretend that the discrimination is an aberration, not the very essence of Israel's basic laws and practices. New subsection, shell game. Mr. Beinart cannot... I hope I got this right. Beinart cannot not know that Israeli law makes a distinction between holding formal citizenship, or what in Hebrew is called ezrahut, while distributing the crucial category of nationality, le'um, on ethnic grounds, thus reserving for Jews the most substantial rights, including that of return and access to land. This distinction was reaffirmed in October by Israel's High Court, which threw out a petition by 21 citizens to have their nationality recorded in the population registry as Israeli rather than Jewish. The court ruled that removing this distinction would endanger Israel's status as a Jewish state. That is to say, one where Jews are privileged above non-Jewish citizens. In this malicious shell game, Palestinians and other non-Jews face not only discrimination, but permanent exclusion from fundamental rights that in virtually every other state, and any claiming to be a democracy, are entailed upon citizenship. New subheading, Palestinians are not, quote, immigrants. Beinart also seeks to cover up another act of exclusion that is fundamental to Israel's character as a racial state. This is his most fabulously Orwellian moment. Quote, the BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions movements call for, quote, respecting, protecting, and promoting the rights of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes and properties, end subquote, denies Israel's right to set its own immigration policy. So does the movement's call for recognizing the fundamental rights of the Arab Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality, which presumably denies Israel's right to maintain the preferential immigration policy that makes it a refuge for Jews, end quote. A refuge for Jews, end quote. Preferential immigration policy, as a phrase, is the sanitary phrase with which Beinart describes the denial to refugees of the right guaranteed under international law to return to their homes. Palestinians in the diaspora, in the Palestinian diaspora, who seek to return are not immigrants, but an indigenous people that has been ethnically cleansed from lands and communities where they have lived for generations. They are the people who lived in the village of Isawiya, on whose expropriated land Hebrew University has built its Rabin building, or who were deported from the destroyed village of Sheikh Mouanis, upon which Tel Aviv University is located. Or they are, like the great poet Mahmoud Darwish, the, quote, present absentees people disappeared almost as much by the richly inventive language of his Israeli discrimination that Beinart echoes as by the actual practices that turn an indigenous people into immigrants or infiltrators. And that process of transfer is ongoing for the inhabitants of occupied East Jerusalem, who, having been consistently denied permits to extend their houses under Israeli quote-unquote law, find their homes demolished or quote-unquote legally expropriated by settlers. The exclusion is ongoing for any Palestinian, quote-unquote, citizen of Israel who, having married another Palestinian from a few miles away in the West Bank, is denied the right to family reunification and must self-transfer to other parts of the occupied territories. Subsection. Rights as, quote, existential threat. Is the Palestinian demand for Israel to, quote, recognize the fundamental rights of the Arab-Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality so outlandish or outrageous? In what other state would such a demand by any minority, indigenous or not, be seen as heralding the destruction of the state or as discriminating against the majority? The examples that come to mind, inevitably, are apartheid in South Africa or Northern Ireland in the days when it was a, quote, Protestant state for a Protestant people, and Catholics who forged a civil rights movement to demand equal rights were confronted with brutal state rejection and violence. Such regimes, based fundamentally in discrimination or in the grossly unequal exercise of power or privilege, always regard any challenge to the system that maintains inequality as an existential threat. Subheading, The Truth of Israel. In this respect, the occupied Palestinian territories are not to be distinguished from the normal or proper state of Israel. It is not only that, as Gideon Levy recently wrote in Haaretz, all Israeli institutions are complicit in the occupation. It is the occupation and its practices that are the truth of Israel itself. The early Zionists, in their recognition of the existence of the indigenous Arab population that would not accept colonialization, in their belief in the necessity of an iron wall of military force to realize their colonial projects, were not only prophetic, they were considerably more honest than current liberal Zionists about the nature of what they were doing. Subsection, Two-State Solution Threatens Palestinians. The increasingly remote possibility of the two-state solution undermined by the daily expansion of illegal settlements, that's illegal Jewish settlements, into the West Bank and East Jerusalem, will not solve the essentially discriminatory nature of an exclusive racial state. Perceived as a demographic threat, another Orwellian euphemism invoked to justify ethnic cleansing, it is Palestinians in Israel who face an existential threat in any two-state solution. Such a so-called solution would not, and should not, put an end to the Palestinian pursuit of justice and equality. Under what dystopian code should any people abandon its rights or its pursuit of equal treatment under law? But this does not mean that the BDS movement intends the, quote, destruction of the state of Israel with all the connotations of genocide or expulsion that phrase more or less openly invokes. It seeks its transformation. Subsection, An Invitation. This is the last, This is the end of the article here. An invitation. The BDS movement demands what Israel actually pretends to be, a normal democracy in a state of all its people. It does not ask anyone to leave or to accept less than equal rights. It asks only that Jews be willing to live on equal terms with non-Jews, with Palestinians or Bedouins, Christian, Muslim, or secular, and to live in a land of all its people. That would be real belonging, not colonial settlement. That is an invitation, not a threat. It is an invitation to Jews everywhere and to all people to realize the emancipatory potential embedded in every struggle for justice and in every act of local or international solidarity with those struggles. It is an invitation to free oneself from the painful contradiction of advocating democracy and defending and supporting oppression. It is an invitation to step out of the meshes of a Zionist dream that has become a nightmare, ever more rigid and repressive, and to replace the possibilities and the risks that true democracy and ethical decolonization entail. Nelson Mandela's death has brought to mind again the fact that for a peace process in South Africa to begin, white South Africans had, to their eventual credit, to stand down from their exclusionary racial privileges. In Northern Ireland, too, Protestants had to relinquish their monopoly on rule, on political rule, on cultural rule, I'm adding those last two phrases, in order for the peace process, for their peace process to begin. Some have called these the costs of peacemaking. Perhaps it would be better to think of them as the gifts peace brings to those willing to contemplate cohabitation in a just society. Author David Lloyd is Distinguished Professor of English at the University of California, Riverside, down there in SoCal. Highly opinionated piece, but all quite accurate. It's all stuff that I've talked about over and over again. I'm sure falling upon many deaf ears, especially those bad guy monitors who are looking for things that they can strain and constrain out of my weekly two dialogues here to ultimately use against me in whatever nefarious manner. But all quite true, indeed all quite true. My friends, it is 1630 hours, 4:30 in the p.m. this Monday, December 30th. 2013. This is the Mideast Migraines Show, brought to you on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM, and of course live at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Scroll down the main page and click on the red oval that you see there quite plainly, and that'll pass you along. That is the effective link to our online streaming service. Of course, understand that in order to hear that service, you will have to run it through. If you're not already set up for this, you need to run it through iTunes or perhaps Windows Media Player. What's that? Real Player Cloud. One of those internet audio media services in order for you to hear the service. When you look at the lower half of the page there, our main page on the web, you will see that red oval surrounded by a number of options like donate, about us, schedule for the current schedule, which was just updated to about 3 days ago, so we have the most current schedule up. But do not click on the word listen. Listen in that crescent of words there is a defunct function. It does not work. In fact, don't even look at it, because if you click on the word listen, you will get some false information telling you that we are not streaming. The corporate vipers got to us a long time ago and eliminated that threat. I wish our web guy would just take down the word listen for now anyway. Do not click on listen. Instead, click on the red oval. And just telling you this over the air, I might be risking the viability of that. Who knows? But it's what we... That's the one way that you can hear us on the internet. So that's the secret key. And, of course, on the very limited 30-watt expansion of our radio signal at 101.3 FM is the other way that you can hear the show. Just as important, at least for this particular show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, go to Mideast Madness. I don't have the archive set up yet for the new title of the show, Mideast Migraines, but go to radioforall.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, the number 4, A-L-L.net, radioforall.net. That is an archive service, not-for-profit service, of course. Just feed the phrase Mideast Madness into the search box, find my shows, and look for a particular show title or date. And as I was saying earlier, I'm reading Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel by Max Blumenthal. Book just came out this year, 2013. On the Saturday show, that's every Saturday morning starting at 11 a.m., 101.3 FM or freakradio.org. Free Radio Santa Cruz. Goliath, the book is I'm being read. I just finished, it was either chapter 13 or 14. Now I can't remember getting into part two of the book. But all the shows, and very soon the one from 2 days ago, will be or are archived at radioforall.net. All the Saturday shows that include the book readings, portions that I can read in the course of about 2 hours, less than 2 hours, and most of my other shows. So you can catch up on the reading of the text of Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, or just fish around for something else that you think has an interesting title, something that you may have heard in the past or heard a portion of or heard about. I mean, everybody in town is talking about this program, right? Right. Gonna have a little more diet here. Okay. The piece on the nightmare of liberal Zionism that I just read to you made mention of Nelson Mandela as we got to the end. Now, here is a quotation from Nelson Mandela. Oh, shoot. The problem is the person who forwarded this to me did not spell out in text the actual quotation that he's referring to from Mr. Mandela, the late Mr. Mandela. Instead, he included a picture of a poster containing the quote, which did not come through. So I'll just have to tell you the quote that my friend here is talking about and wants everyone to make go viral so we can get our point across is a statement from President Nelson Mandela, probably while he was still the South African president, and not verbatim, but it's very simple. Mr. Mandela simply said, "Our struggle for freedom and independence is not complete without the freedom and the independence of the Palestinian people." Nelson Mandela said that, folks. So for people who brush aside any comparisons between Mandela and, say, Yasser Arafat, or between Mandela and Omar Barghouti, or any other current hero amongst the Palestinian people, just keep that phrase in mind. Nelson Mandela said, essentially, the South African struggle for equality and freedom is incomplete without the equality and freedom of the Palestinian people. Something like that. Okay. Moving on here. Speaking still of Mandela, here's something fairly fresh from a couple of weeks ago. A petition to Israel and the world media. Mandela and Vanunu, Men of Courage, by Marid McGuire, Nobel Peace Laureate. This petition will be retweeted here, and they give you a link, daily at Benjamin Netanyahu and other politicians and the world media until they report or Israel allows Vanunu to, quote, get on the first plane out of Israel. Who is this Vanunu person? Hopefully, I'll tell you if the text doesn't explain it. Sign and continue to share until a free Vanunu is reality. 201 signed, 99 more needed. That was as of December 18, some 12 days ago. Okay, folks, even though it says deadline was 25 December, which was 5 days ago, I'm going to read you the text. Mandela and Vanunu, Men of Courage by Marid McGuire, Nobel Peace Laureate. This week, the world's political leaders stood united in admiration at the memorial service in South Africa to honor the memory of Nelson Mandela, leader of his country and a man of courage who gave inspiration to many people around the world. Across the world in East Jerusalem in solitude sits another man of courage, Mordecai Vanunu. In 1986, Vanunu, the Israeli nuclear whistleblower, told the world about Israel's secret nuclear weapons. For this, he served 18 years in an Israeli prison, 12 of which were in solitary confinement. 12 years in solitary, folks. And since his release in 2004, he has been forbidden to leave Israel, speak to foreigners, and is constantly under surveillance. Who knows whether or not those last three were official conditions of his release. Reading on here. On 25 December 2013, Christmas Day, he will be brought again before an Israeli Supreme Court and will yet again ask for his right to leave Israel. The Supreme Court can give him his freedom to go get on a plane and leave Israel as he wishes to do. I, Mary McGuire, appeal to President Shimon Peres, to Prime Minister Netanyahu, to let him go. He is a man of peace, desiring freedom, who followed his conscience. He is no threat to Israel. He, like Mandela, has served now 27 years and deserves his freedom. Interesting comparison of time lapsed. To the world's political leaders who recognize in Mandela a man of courage and a man of honor and courage, and saluted him. I appeal to you to do all in your power to help Vanunu get his freedom now. You have it in your power to do so. Please do not be silent whilst Mordecai Vanunu suffers and is refused his basic rights. To the world's media, I appeal to you to report on Vanunu's continuing isolation and enforced silence by Israel. To civil communities everywhere, I appeal to you to increase your efforts for Vanunu freedom and demand Israel let our brother Mordecai go. We cannot be free while he is not free. Mary Corrigan McGuire, Nobel Peace Laureate. 15 December 2013. Go to peacepeople.com. read about Vanunu's Christmas Day appeal in the New York Times. GOO.GL/CTWYEP. Signed, TNT, Tell Nuclear Truths. Well, I'll see what I can do about finding out the current status of that. I will be extremely surprised and exuberant if the man was let free. In the meantime, I'll just see if I can pull this off. While I'm reading the other stuff to you. Folks, it's only 4:43. There's a good 12 minutes left of program here. You can still call me at 831-427-3772. Even if you know me, at least think of this as a guest book. All my buds out there, my cohorts, my colleagues, those who think much as I do, some more so than others, some less so, give me a call at area code 831-427-3772. I refer to this as a kind of guest book just so I can get a good idea who's calling, not because I'm trying to keep tabs on the entire world, but if I do know who you are or where you're coming from, then I have a better idea of who all is listening to the show. Don't forget, MideastMadness@gmx.com is the email address for this program, brought to you by Free Radio Santa Cruz. MideastMadness@gmx.com. The show is now entitled Mideast Migraines. I'm still trying to get that information on Mordecai Vanunu. See if I can get anything. Really? Aha. Aha. Before, okay. Well, this is what I have, my friends. The Supreme Court sitting as a high court of justice. The Israel High Court ruling on Vanunu petition to relax such and such. Very official looking document. Judgment. Either from or to Vice President Imaza. I take that to mean the Vice President either of Israel or of the Knesset, Israeli Parliament. The main purpose of this petition is the petitioner's request that the court instruct Respondent 1, head of the Homefront Command, to cancel an order of restrictions and supervision he had issued against Petitioner 1 and instruct Petitioner 2, the Minister, to cancel... to cancel an order he had issued barring the petitioner from leaving Israel. Further, the petitioner has asked the court to determine that the defense regulations 1945 are null and void, and also determine that Regulation 6 of the State of Emergency Regulations exit from the country is likewise null and void. That seems to be the bottom line. The background of this proceeding is that the Vanunu affair, which has preoccupied the court and Israeli society for the past 18 years, the main points of it are known, and I will sum them up. I'm not even sure if this is the most recent or if this is really refers to the past 18 years when Vanunu was actually incarcerated. President A. Barak. That would be Ehud Barak, yes, that's the former prime minister. No, I'm not seeing a decipherable date on this. I'm seeing No dates at all. So this could be the judgment immediately following his 18-year imprisonment, Vanunu's imprisonment, or it could be the most recent one. It's just the text, raw text, if you want to call it raw. There's all kinds of weird characters and things on this. There are 15 major sections or paragraphs in the very last one, number 15. The above stated reasons have led me to the conclusion that this petition must be dismissed. But again, I don't know if this is the most recent petition or the one 18 years from Mordecai Vanunu's initial incarceration. I appreciate you all hanging there with me. I'm just trying to get the most recent results of the petition, the efforts to... Ooh, there's a terrible black and white picture here of a man being suffocated with, I don't know, a ether-soaked cloth here. Is that Mr. Vanunu? Many pictures of Mordecai Vanunu. No, nothing decipherable in terms of Mr. Vanunu's current status. I'm dedicating this portion of the show, obviously, to get the latest on the man. Of course, he has a Facebook page. Well, Free Mordecai Vanunu Facebook. That's got to have something, right? Israel's Supreme Court decision on nuclear whistleblower Mordecai Vanunu's December 25th appeal for freedom. To be announced soon. We're well past the petition deadline of Christmas Day by 5 days. Help Free Vanunu. Thanks to all who have done something to help. Free Mordecai. A petition to world media in Israel. We are not free until Vanunu is free. Well, shades of Nelson Mandela's solidarity with the Palestinians. We are not free until Vanunu is free. Okay, I'm going to settle at this point of all the searching. I don't want to waste any more time here. I don't want to make fruitless the time I have remaining, that we have remaining. Suffice it to say, the latest on Mr. Mordecai's freedom is that we will hear from the Supreme Court soon. Okay? Okay. Okay. Now let's get back to the let's go. We have 5 minutes left of the show. Not a whole heck of a lot of time, but let's see if I can mention. I was really hoping I would get to this piece, the New York Review of Books. I take that to mean New York Times Review of Books on events since British Mandate. I at least want to mention that so you have something that you can look forward to when you tune into next Monday's Mideast Migraines at 3 p.m. NYBooks.com. Let's just get a glimmer of an idea of what this talks about. Palestine, how bad and good was British rule? By author Avishai Margalit. Out of Palestine, The Making of Modern Israel, a new book by Hadar Al-Azhar. I guess Avishai Margalit is critiquing the book. Palestine, How Bad and Good Was British Rule? Out of Palestine, The Making of Modern Israel. Atlas and Company, 290 pages, $25.95. I'll just start to read it here. I've got 3 minutes left in the program. February 7 is the critique. Last February, 11 months ago. The British rule over Palestine lasted roughly 30 years, from 1917 until 1948. In a country that has 3,000 years of recorded history, 30 years is a tiny fraction. If we conceive of 3,000 years on a scale of one day, the period of British rule takes barely 8 minutes. In comparison, Turkish Ottoman rule over Palestine, which I mentioned early in today's show, which lasted 400 years, takes an hour and 40 minutes. Yet the influence of these 30 years was deep and wide-ranging. Under British rule, Palestine became a political unit, not a marginal province of something else. The British made Jerusalem the capital city of Palestine. They introduced the idea of professional civil service, and they encouraged a lively civil society. They built roads and airfields and provided sound legal institutions and reliable police. The legal frame for British rule was based on a mandate conferred on Britain by the League of Nations. The League of Nations was the organization roughly upon which the modern United Nations was based. League of Nations came about as a result of World War I, but it, of course, failed, leading to World War II, which led to the United Nations. Continuing with book critique, it was meant to be a transitory mandate conferred on Britain by the League of Nations. It was meant to be a transitory trusteeship so as to prepare the country to be a, quote, national home for the Jews without impairing the civil and religious rights of the indigenous Arab people. This contradictory task is at the heart of the story of the British mandate. It is this mandate of the League of Nations that makes us call the political and military rule of the British over Palestine, quote, the mandate. And it's the mandate that revived the old term, Palestine, already used by Herodotus in his writings to describe the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. Before then, the Ottomans divided the region into their own units, including, for example, the Sanjak of Jerusalem. The mandate didn't provide collective liberty, namely political independence. It did not provide for elections, for local administrations that would ultimately be under British control, but it did provide a great deal of personal freedom. Following the Ottoman Empire's millet system, the mandate left a great deal of internal autonomy to the various religious communities to conduct their life. All right, folks, it is 4:55, just about time for Palestine Today, a brief collection of headlines about what's happening in Palestine this December 30th. I will decide by next week if I shall continue to read this critique of the new book in the New York Review of Books. I will decide in the next 7 days if I'm going to continue, if it's worth our time. But my friend David Schermerhorn, who forwarded the article to me, the critique to me, did say this. This link leads to an earlier article in the New York Review of Books by Avishai Margalit that outlines the evolution of Israeli-Palestinian relations since the British mandate. Now, this is critical. David says, you may not agree with all the observations, but it is worth reading. Thank you, David Schermerhorn. Okay, folks. Well, you know, got to say goodbye until Monday for the regular weekday version of Mideast Migraine starting at 3 p.m. And, of course, stop by at 101.3 FM and or as far as I'm concerned. Freakradio.org. Click on the red oval for the streaming link. On Saturday, 11 a.m., for my continued reading of Max Blumenthal's book, Goliath, etc., etc., etc. Thank you.